Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 22nd episode of the CodeCast Podcast today. As we close out the first quarter of 2018, we've started a new series called Top 10 Tuesday for the last Tuesday of each month. So these are top 10 questions and my response to them for my on-demand Coding Corner membership service. So last month I did a top 8, but I really needed to do a top 10. And I think I added a couple as well. And so Top 10 Tuesday is also easy to remember. If you're a Coding Corner member, you may find your question on air here too. So what this is, just quickly, is a membership. It's paid yearly, and you can find it on my website at terryfletcher.net. It's for coders and billers and collectors and physicians and medical practices, and you can utilize it for coding and billing questions. So you have a question, or you run into trouble, or you need something worked on for you, need help with an appeal letter or coding for or an op report. Basically, it's a paid membership that gets you unlimited emailed questions for a year, and then you can renew. And I post some of these questions as well on my blog page on my website. But I thought it would be kind of a good idea, and we got great response to it last month, to do it as a live podcast, so kind of a live blog. I'm going to kind of talk you through it. And that way you can see my responses and conclusions and get comfortable with how I respond to some of your questions and see if this is something, you know, that you can use in your office as far as not only, you know, the podcast, but also joining the service. So hopefully you find it helpful. Before we get started, as always, we'd like to thank our sponsoring partners. Trident University International. Trident is a leading online university regionally accredited by WASC, serving members of the military, veterans, and their families. Trident.edu. And Better Living. Since 2002, Better Living has been the premier digital lifestyle brand dedicated to travel, food, health, home, and more on betterliving.com. And the FIA Group, an experienced provider of healthcare cost containment techniques, offering services designed to control healthcare costs and protect plan assets. FIAGroup.com. Okay, so let's take a look at our first question here. And then this will also give you a feel for my specialties. And I am heavy cardiology, but we also do pulmonary, orthopedic, GI, and, you know, auditing, E&M. So we have a lot of specialties that we really address as well. So the first one says, Terry, my physician implanted a dual chamber pacemaker on January 30th. The patient comes back in today, so we'll assume that it's in March, and they go over the post-op information for the implant and discuss any questions the patient has. My physician added the diagnosis of hypertension to the fee ticket and charged an office visit. There is a 90-day global for device implants, as you know, but can I charge for this office visit? So here is the answer to that question. First of all, patients who have implanted devices such as pacemakers or implantable defibrillators also a lot of times have comorbidities. They also have several chronic conditions, and hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, those are some of the, to name a few. If your physician finds that the patient today who is a known hypertension patient is having an elevated blood pressure that they need to address, meaning that they need to modify a medication or treat it or talk it through or change a diet, change something because of that unrelated diagnosis to why the implant was done, then you have an argument for an additional E&M service. You would use a 24 modifier attached to, let's say, a 99213. Which is a level 3 established patient visit. But let me caution you on this. The 24 modifier is the number one modifier that the RAC audits, and you know what those are. Those are the recovery audits that Medicare does, basically saying that we're seeing a pattern in this practice where they tend to overcode or they're coding certain things incorrectly. And so they're monitoring you. And that modifier is used incorrectly quite a bit. So we just want to make sure that if you address something, if it's truly unrelated to the global service that you're providing, then you can code for it. You know, another example would be, let's say you're in a general surgery practice and the patient had an appendectomy 30 days ago. Patient comes back in, doctor looks at the wound site, everything looks great. And the patient says something like, oh, by the way, doc, and we get a lot of those oh, by the way visits. And basically says, you know, I felt like I palpated a mass in my right breast area. Can you take a look at it? So at that point, when the doctor then goes and takes a look and does a full and complete history and exam and then makes a medical decision, are they going to aspirate anything that they found? Are they going to set the patient up for an appointment for maybe a biopsy? Or they didn't find anything and then they document it that way. It was really just something the patient, you know, was concerned about. Is that billable? It is. It's, you know, a breast mass is not related to appendicitis. But when you get into patients that just happen to have a different diagnosis and it's not something that you're addressing, stay away from trying to bill this outside the global period. It'll be a problem. So we just don't want you to get in trouble, and we want to make sure you use that with caution. So number two says, my physician performed a percutaneous coronary intervention, so that's the acronym PCI, on a patient after he did a heart cath. But the payer is saying that the cath procedure is bundled. It doesn't have global days, so how can I get paid? So something I want to bring to your attention when it comes to coronary interventions and heart caths. So the intervention part is what we call a therapeutic intervention, meaning that once you find something from the heart cath, which is considered a diagnostic tool, so they go into the heart, they inject, they may actually just go into the coronaries, but if they cross over the aortic valve, go into the heart, inject with contrast, then they can see on the screen if there's a lesion or a blockage or an occlusion, they call it, in that area. And then from that blockage that they found, they'll go in and do something called an angioplasty, which is a ballooning or an inflation of that narrowed vessel to get a more normal diameter. Or they'll put in a stent, and they usually do also some post-angioplasty on that. And a stent is basically, I like to call it basically kind of a place setter or a fastener. It pushes the disease to the wall of those arteries or vessels and lets blood flow through. Or they'll do an atherectomy. Now remember the code, ectomy means to take out, atherosclerosis, they're taking out disease. And so if they do any of these interventions based on what they found in their cardiac cath, then yes, you can bill for both. You need a 59 modifier on your cardiac cath. So let's say you went into the heart, you injected both the coronaries, and you also measured pressures in the aorta, and you did a left ventricular injection. So that would be 93458 with a 26 modifier. And then let's say you found something, the doctor found something within that heart cath, so they stented the left anterior descending artery, which would be 92928 LD. Well, you need to go back and put, if it's a commercial plan, a 59 modifier on the heart cath, because they are bundled. The CPT book says don't bill it if there's a previous heart cath or if it's not diagnostic, meaning that you're still looking for a problem. If it's Medicare, I like to use a 59 modifier, subset modifier. I use the XU. So X is an X-ray, U is an umbrella. That modifier basically says it's a non-overlapping service. So if you're using that modifier, you're telling the insurance company that I'm billing this because it is a diagnostic service, and I did not do it just to set up the intervention, the stenting. So I'm doing it not as road mapping, I'm doing it more to still find something. So that's where you want to be careful and just make sure that you can support it, and that's how you get paid. You go back in with, first of all, with the modifiers need to be correct, and then make sure that your diagnoses are different. The heart cath would be for chest pain, maybe angina, palpitations, and then your result of your intervention would be probably coronary artery disease. So that really gives the payer also an understanding that one led to the other. Number three says, an established Medicare patient with a plan of care to treat their chronic knee osteoarthritis came into our orthopedic clinic for an office visit. The patient's physician was not available for the visit, and he had an emergency at the hospital. So our PA, which is our mid-level, saw the patient. She performed a level 3 office visit, 99213, and then recommended that the patient return for a knee injection with the physician at another appointment. One of our partners, another MD, was in the clinic at the time. So how do I bill this incident too? Can I bill it under the doctor that had to run to the hospital since there was a doctor in clinic? Or do I have to bill it with the doctor that's actually there? So the rules under incident 2, and that's a Medicare billing guideline, it means where does the physician have to be able to bill that visit under the physician, even though they did not see the patient. It's considered an established visit only in the office, so there was already a plan of care in place. And if that happens, basically it's the doctor that is on call, or the one that's there, I shouldn't say on call, but the one that's in the practice that is considered the supervising physician today. Okay, so if the second doctor is there, the partner, and the patient's seen by the PA, and they sign off on that, or what they call authenticate the record, then you can bill that as that 99213 under the physician that's in clinic. The doctor that had to run to the hospital, they would not get credit for that day. But the good thing about incident two is that your patients are actually getting to be seen. And so we really want to make sure we're understanding that, you know, you can bill for that, but you have to follow the rules. I was in a practice this last week down here in Southern California, and they're utilizing a nurse practitioner from the hospital. And I said, is it your employee? And they said, no. And I said, so what are you utilizing her for? And they said, well, she's basically seeing the patients first, and the doctors are going in and just signing off on the hospital records. I'm like, oh boy. So remember, you have to employ this person to be able to charge for this service. If you don't employ them, then you can't use any part of anything that they do. They have to be your employee. Just keep in mind that if you're going to pass along an expense to a patient, you better have incurred an expense. That's what the relative value unit, or the RVU for every code, means. It means that you have expense there. That's why you want to make money on it. Okay, number four says, one of our orthopedists performed a closed treatment of a radial shaft fracture without manipulation, and I reported the code 25500. The payer denied the claim. When I called the payer for an explanation, a representative said that the notes did not indicate that the provider performed or initiated fracture care. What does this mean, and how or what do I look for to show that my provider performed or initiated fracture care? Okay, so fracture care codes are very generic when it does not include manipulation. So in order to report fracture care correctly, the provider does need to document with some accuracy. They need to state that they are initiating fracture care in the notes and show they are providing closed treatment of the fracture. And it can be strapping or casting. You know, it doesn't have to be anything specific. There's not a surgery. It's more mobilizing that arm or that wrist in this case. The mobilization of a fracture is defined as care. Unfortunately, the code is just so generic. And in its language, it's really hard to explain that to the payer. So as long as it's in the initial assessment, in the words that reflect treatment or initiation of fracture care, you have support for an appeal if you get denied. So just remind your physicians that language is key. And with the ICD-10 specificity that we're having to deal with, they're going to know that this is just another step to help out. Number five says, I have a patient that showed up in the ER with an acute MI or heart attack, but my physician is a primary care doctor and called in the cardiologist to consult on the patient and work them up. How do I code for an unspecified acute myocardial infarction? Okay, so then there's a new code in 2018, and it is called for an unspecified acute MI, and it's I-21.9. The official guidelines state that this is used as a default for unspecified acute myocardial infarctions or unspecified type. They said if only the STEMI code or transmural MI is the one that you're supposed to code. That was how you were supposed to code it before these new codes came out, I-21.3. But now, before this edition, you would not have been able to code that I-21.9. So luckily, ICD-10 caught up with this dilemma and this scenario, and this isn't a more accurate description of the encounter. Because you have one doctor that's really just saying, I need you to come in because this patient's having a heart attack, but you need to work them up. So number six is, hi Terry, I manage my practice's revenue cycle team. This used to be called Central Billing Office. I know nowadays everybody wants to use really fancy words when they talk about revenue cycles, and they talk about RCM, which is Risk Control Matrix, and I'm hearing all kinds of different, you know, acronyms and things like that, and I am just like, just be clear in your language, people. You're confusing everybody. So anyway, going back, it says, I manage my patient's revenue cycle team, and I'd like your feedback on how I can better understand how we are doing now and what we can do better. We are a small team and work together in a back office, and I feel like we're forgotten when bonuses are handed out. We're in charge of the money and not considered for bonuses seems counterproductive. So how can I show my boss that my team is really pulling our weight for the whole office? So first you need to know what you're working with and then where you need to improve. So you need to make sure you have team members that are experts in different payers, not just handling patient accounts by alphabetical names. That's the worst way to handle it. Equip everyone with tools and workflow guidance to ask suggestions, and offer suggestions, and how to pursue research. No detail is too small. If you have team members that have issues or are uncomfortable asking patients to pay on their accounts, practice talking through those scenarios with role-playing until everyone's comfortable in their roles. And really make sure when you do role-playing that you have the worst patient possible and just give every possible negative scenario and then ease back into the positive things. But empower your staff with knowledge, empower them with education, and with responsibility for their job. Make sure they're trained not only on computers and software, but also on how to run efficient reports and productivity reports, such as the AR, so they can show from 1 month to the next how they're progressing. And then always have an open door policy to questions. I love the Dropbox questions. That way it's not just coming in and complaining, but make something very clear to your staff. And my daughter, before she became a teacher, she's now subbing while she's getting her teaching credential. She worked for Starbucks, like a lot of kids do. And, you know, she said that there was always, whenever she would have a complaint or I'm noticing that she would talk to me about a complaint at work, it was never about the job. It was always about the person. I said, rephrase your question because that's not what they want to hear. And you're going to deal with this in any job you have during your life. So if somebody isn't pulling their weight, you say something to the effect that this isn't being done this way, or we really need to try and do this instead of, you know, Susie Smith isn't doing this. Always make it about the work, not the person. If there's a problem person, believe me, at some point somebody's going to figure it out that's in the higher ranking areas. But you just want to focus on what is or isn't getting done as far as the work. And that way that gives you credibility that you're not saying anything against anybody. You just want to make sure the work is done accurately. But make sure that you do have a suggestion box so you're not just walking in on your boss whenever. And then if you are a boss listening to this, you need a suggestion box that you can look through once a week. And then I would put it on email. Just say, here was a question that came out. Don't call anybody out if you know their writing or how they fill it out, you know, and don't be upset about that. So make sure if you give a box or you have an open door policy to questions, then you need to be respectful that people need to be allowed to, you know, to ask questions. The next one says, I live in the tri-state area. Many of our patients, I like this question, live in a different state than our medical practice. Additionally, many of the payers we work with are across state lines too. If I am preparing an appeal, how do I know which state regulations to follow? Okay, so this one's pretty easy. Things can get confusing though quickly when you are dealing with multiple state regulations, in addition to having to know your own state's rules as well as federal regulations. But luckily the answer is simple. Whichever state the medical care took place in, that's the state whose regulations apply to your appeal, even if the payer is located elsewhere. So wherever the care took place, that's what follows the patient. Number 8 says, you recently wrote a featured article about a new specialty physician taxonomy code, C7, for advanced heart failure and transplant cardiology. Can you tell me more about this specialty? Sure. So I like it when the Medicare comes up with these specialty designations, and that's what a taxonomy code is. And so basically it gives a physician more of an identity on their subspecialty. So instead of a general cardiology, if they're doing heart failure, they're doing intervention, it really helps to pinpoint those physicians who maybe are treating at a higher level. And so in the heart failure specialty and transplant, if your cardiologist specializes in heart failure and transplant cardiology, they have received further training in treating cardiovascular disease by focusing on managing advanced and complicated heart failure in a way that goes beyond what general internists and cardiologists can provide. And this is according to the American College of Physicians. So heart failure and transplant cardiology programs, what they do is they teach physicians to treat patients who represent with particularly challenging cases of heart failure. They use a variety of electrophysiology and hemodynamic support devices. They perform complex percutaneous and surgical procedures, and then they evaluate prospective patients for heart transplants, valve replacements and implants, and also assist the facilities in facilitating those treatments. And so it is really important that if you find this kind of subspecialty or this kind of update in taxonomy, that you apply to get your physician upgraded. I guess it is an upgrade. You know, just really, yeah, I actually like how I put that, upgraded to making sure that they have that designation. So it also can help you if you have a patient that you need to see as a new patient. You know, you have I'm just picking on cardiology here, you have got a cardiology patient that needs to be evaluated for a potential valve transplant or valve implantation, then you want to make sure that you have the right physician looking at that. So that can actually help you there. Number 9 says, in one of your CodeCast podcasts, you discussed ACP, which is advanced care planning. My physician is interested in adding this to our charge master sheet, but I want to make sure we are correct that it is a billable service and Medicare will pay for it. So yes, Medicare started paying for voluntary ACP services, again, advanced care planning, at the beginning of 2017. So this means you now can collect for your cardiologist or primary care physicians or oncologist or any physician having these important conversations with patients. Your codes are 99497 and 99498. Make sure you look them up in your CPT book for the code description and the time element involved, because there is time element. And what you're doing is you're discussing with patients advanced directive planning. So you may be completing relevant legal forms such as power of attorney, medical power of attorney, and again, advanced directive. But patients have to give their consent to have these discussions before you assume that they want to have them. They're always voluntary, so let them know up front that you'll be billing for this time, and they may be subject to deductible and copay because there are out-of-pocket costs of this, so there are share of costs. These are not billable as a telemedicine service right now, so make sure you register for my webinar on this topic as well. We're going to have one of these in April. But the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that read the code. The patient doesn't necessarily need to be present for these conversations as long as they have signed an authorization for you to talk to their family about it. And so you can have an ACP discussion without a patient there as long as you have an authorization for the patient from the patient that you're allowed to discuss it with the patient. And then you can bill for that service under the patient's insurance. It's very rare that we get that. So we have to be very careful. What this isn't, so just to be clear, had a question that came up yesterday in a meeting I was giving. And it basically, they said, you know, sometimes we have really sick patients, and they said that, can you talk to my daughter-in-law or my daughter? And they come in and they talk to them. And they said, how do we bill that? We want to bill that consultative effort underneath the patient, but Medicare says we can't because the patient isn't there. Medicare is correct on that service because that's an E&M code. And so the patient would have to be face-to-face along with that family member to have that discussion. This is typically just for patients that, in my opinion, within the next 24 months, they could die. They could have, you know, learn of their, they're going downhill, they're not doing well. And it's really a value-added service for your patient. So just kind of be aware of that. It's not for everybody. Do not have this as a blanket service for everybody. But it also is a way to, you know, really give a value service to your patients that I would guarantee you your doctors are probably having these conversations. Number 10, this is our last one for today. It says, my physician learned at your live seminar that he can bill for smoking cessation services, which we are getting paid on, so thank you for that. But I noticed in his entries into the medical record that he only states, quote unquote, lengthy discussion with patient on the benefits of quitting smoking. Is that enough to code the 99406 or the 99407? Okay, that would be no. So I'm glad that your physician heard that you can pick this value-added service up. I'm always looking for hidden revenue or revenue opportunities, as you know. But these are time-based codes. So the conversation would have to be, had a 4-minute discussion with patient on the benefits of quitting smoking. We gave the patient a prescription for Chantix or something like that. And the patient is understanding that we'll be following up with them on their success of this program. So understanding that you get about 4 a year, or let me rephrase, the patient gets 4 a year. So you want to make sure that you know that the other physicians could be coding for it. One nice thing though about smoking cessation is that it is, it waives the copay and deductible for a patient. And so there is no out-of-pocket for them. So that's really, really helpful. And so we just want to make sure that patients know that, you know, if they're a smoker, and look at your specialty. You know, if you are an orthopedic practice, that is going to affect patients that are having spine surgery or total joints or anything like that. If you are a dermatology practice and you have patients with basal cell and skin issues, you know, that's going to affect them as well. If you've got a general surgery practice or a gastro practice and you're dealing with, colon issues, oh my gosh, smoking is absolutely a problem for that. So just, and don't even get me started on cardiology. So you have to just make sure that if you're having those conversations with patients, that you're capturing the service. And luckily we do have some payers now that are willing to pay for it. Okay, so we have completed our Top 10 Tuesday. I'd like to end with our final sponsor today, and that would be Do. So they make it easier to get paid online. Do customers love how they make payments easier, faster, and smoother. DUE.com. That's Do.com. So we're going to go ahead and close it out today. Everyone have a great rest of your day. Don't forget to check out my website for webinars, seminars, and other coding and reimbursement tools, memberships, and publications. You can also get some books on there on coding. And then next week, we're going to talk about new versus established E&M patients. I know that's been a really hot topic lately, and we want to make sure that you have the clarification, especially with those big practices that are dealing with a lot of subspecialties. So pass that along, so hopefully you'll join us next week. Again, have a great day, everybody.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer DeSassin Music.